We're back with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was asking of Howard Mansfield this business about being an immigrant. How does a youngster growing up in Long Island, or as one can say jokingly, Long Island, there is a transition here from growing up on Long Island, which is quite a different experience from being a Yankee. But how?
Well, you can never be a Yankee if you're from what I used to call it. I would tell people I'm a Flatlander and I'm from the flattest place on the East Coast.
Is that correct?
Well, just a couple of feet above sea level, yes. In fact, the highest point on Long Island is a hill. It's like 419 feet above sea level, called Jane's Hill.
But who's counting?
Every foot, 404 feet or whatever it is. But it's right at the base of that. Well, Walt Whitman was born in Huntington, and that's where he sort of started his wandering and everything.
Which is very important to America, whether we know it or not.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Walt Whitman is sort of a key figure as far as making poetry out of a specific place and locale.
The thing that I found most, well, it's just heart-stopping, was when you were remembering where you grew up on Long Island under the spirit of Walt Whitman, and then you start telling me about Walt Whitman Mall.
Isn't that great?
I couldn't make it fit.
And I never have. All the years since, I could never make sense of it. This is in the early 1960s, and this was going to be like the first enclosed mall in the New York area, one of the first in the country. And Walt Whitman was born right across the road from, which is across parking lots and lanes of traffic. And his birthplace is now squeezed between a furniture store and another store. And I thought, Walt Whitman Mall. You just cannot make sense of it. You could just imagine the security people asking Walt Whitman, "Move along now, just move along."
Well, he would have been very unpopular, out of place. I would think, or maybe not. Maybe adaptive enough that
he'd loved. In his day, there's the Whitman who's a poet of nature, and there's the Whitman who's a poet of crowds. I mean, he loved crossing Brooklyn Ferry, and he liked riding up and down Broadway with the Teamsters and everything. But a mall, again, is another thing. It's just a very controlled environment, and I just have a hard time with his name on it. If his poetry were more living with people, I think it would be different. But obviously, his name is there because people don't read him.
This is a wonderful opening to practice our French.
Ah, flaneur. FLANEUR. You speak of one of your chapters in The Bones of the Earth talks about flaneur. How'd I do, guys?
Fool me.
Made my high school French teacher proud.
Oh, good. Would that mine had been.
And like mine, she's dead probably.
Yeah. Speak to this notion. It's an important one. Whitman, you say, was one. And in a very real sense, you are and or aspire to be one. This is a wonderful notion.
Yeah, I always put that down in those forms for occupation. I write down flaneur.
And then what do you say when they say, was that?
Well, they never ask. In 19th century Paris, there was the intellectuals there had this idea about how you would walk around the city and how you would look at a city.
And it was a new kind of idea.
In other words, you wouldn't get out your tour guide and you'd go see this monument, that monument. You would stroll about and you would try and get a sense of the crowd and a sense of the soul of the crowd. And you would just kind of inhale it in a sense. Walter Benjamin wrote quite a bit about this. But I think it's a great way to take that home to where you live and become a flaneur of your own home place and look at things you've gone past for 20 years and actually go there and just kind of stroll around and look at it. The other great thing about the flaneur idea is they were very interested in what the crowd was and what the crowd was doing. And people were very terrified of crowds, as you know.
And you say that crowds were kind of a new phenomenon.
That's what the intellectual historians tell us. Of the late 19th century, and their idea was that they would go out to greet the crowd and just see what the crowd was thinking. So I want in the book I wanted to apply that to think home things. I mean,
think look, home things.
Yeah, home things. What I mean by home things is I guess the best way to put it is Henry David Thoreau famously said, "I've traveled much and conquered," and that's what would be the great thing for people to do, to become tourists of the near at hand, to celebrate the ordinary, to go look at things. And by looking at them, really start to see them and lift them up from invisibility.
Things like
landscapes, ordinary buildings, places that in past times would have been regarded as sacred and real and enough. But today we drive past because they're not big enough, they're not technicolor enough, they're not huge enough. A tree, a rock, a bend in the river in the morning. that's real. That's life. And when we don't know that, then we'll never really feel at home.
Some of the pleasure of reading what you write is that it feels quiet.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's sort of an anti-noise device. It's almost like an anechoic chamber.
It's an invitation to slow down and look.
You. Well, slow down and look and listen. And but to engage in the space. And I'm sitting here thinking about this and thinking about the Walt Whitman Mall. and in the context of the flaneur, because on one hand, you can make, and you do suggest that one way of approaching a mall, or, God help us, a strip mall, is with that same sense of discovery and interest and engagement.
Even at a mall.
Well, exactly.
And I will say, that's a stretch.
Well,
and
I
had the sense that you were stretching, too.
Well, you know, I wanted to really, because, you know, I hit the commercial strip, this particular commercial strip that's about a half hour from our house. And, but, you know, as I say in the book, by the time I'm a few traffic lights in, I am just Cotton Mather at the wheel. I am just fulminating. I am just so upset. And this is miserable. And this is the death of us. And I do think that. But can I look at it? Can I see something new? So I went, I got an architect friend of mine who, when he was at Yale, was a part of a very famous Yale studio that went to Las Vegas. And they wrote this famous book, Learning from Las Vegas. And they went up and down the strip there and said, well, what is going on here? And actually, that book is wonderful. And it still is wonderful because what they said was, the buildings don't matter, the signs matter. And as long as you know one of the huge problems that every zoning board around the country has is trying to keep the signs down and small. And also that the buildings become a sign. And then you know everything you need to know about franchise architecture right there.
But you talk about, for instance, just to finish that thought, if you will, you talk about how horizontal our buildings have become. Well, we got lots of land, and so we sort of spread out over it. But that hasn't always been the case. It's not inevitable. And if we think about it, then we might have something on which to act. But it all starts with noticing, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's an old quip, you probably know it, that Americans waste space and Europeans waste time. And it's true. We just, J.B. Jackson, the great cultural geographer, he pointed that out about how everything is sprawled out on one level, and you see that on the strip too. But you also, on the commercial strip, you just get this sense of, well, why is this so unsatisfying? And I think because the commercial strip is a cartoon strip, and we are reduced to cartoons. We are all appetite. We are all about getting and spending, and there's no civic culture there. There's no place of grace. And if this is such freedom, why is it tyranny? I think it succeeds as a marketplace, but it fails in every other thing that we need to have going on in the country.
Well, it does. You know, it feels noisy. It looks noisy.
And it
part
being
of, those environments,
particularly
the strip mall,
sure,
and the things that go with that. It also, you mentioned the commercial piece of that, and part of this is yelling more loudly than your neighbor, "Look at me."
And with when a sign or with,
oh, sure,
yelling.
And
at
when everybody
flags,
is yelling, look at me, I mean, it's sort of what the media has become, you know, what now passes for political discussion seems to be part of that same thing. Everybody's saying, look at me, listen to me, believe me, trust me. And the way that you establish trust and, gather attention is by yelling it more loudly and in some cases more offensively.
And having a bigger sign.
Than the other guy.
I think the other aspect of the two is curiously associating yourself with domestic values at the same time. In other words, this is a big, huge multinational corporation or something, but they sell happiness, the colors are nice, you're going to go in there, they're going to be happy to see you. I mean, I think it's all in that word Home Depot. I mean, home is, it's to the heart, it's central. Depot, it's huge, it's a warehouse. I mean, so warehouse of the heart? I mean, it's that conflict right there.
Can we move boldly from flaneur to ersatz?
Well, we can do that when we come back, because it's going to take more than a minute to do that. We are talking with Howard Mansfield. Many of these ideas have come home to roost, if I may, in a wonderful book that he calls The Bones of the Earth. It's very much like his other work. We'll talk about things that are the bones of the earth. We can talk about ersatz, if you will, Bill Russell. And I am Paula Gordon. Be with us when we return.